Stepping out of the reed boat, the woman's feet sank deep into the mud. It was thick, black stuff, the fine, fertile Nile silt deposited by the river's annual floods. The river had only just started to fall after months of rising waters. Soon it would be time to start sowing the fields on either bank. But there was still a little time to spare before the work began in earnest. The mud oozed up to the woman's ankles and squelched with every step. Dragging the boat away from the bank to drier land took effort, especially when the little reed craft was loaded full of baskets of grain. But the workers at the building site needed to eat, and that meant straining her back and getting thick clods of soil stuck all over her feet. When the boat was finally out of the mud, she nearly collapsed from exhaustion. Bending at the waist and bracing her hands on her hips, she stopped to catch a few deep breaths. Every one of her 40 years seemed to stab at her aching hands, legs, and joints, punishing her for the endless days of toil that made up her daily life. Grinding grain was the worst, a never-ending punishment for the wrists and fingers. Carrying water from the river was a close second. Paddling a boat and pulling it onto the riverbank wasn't nearly as bad as those two interminable tasks, which was why she had volunteered to bring their village's grain downstream to the building site. But it still took its toll. Everything did. Her hair, which had been thick and black in her younger years, had thinned dramatically after 6 pregnancies and a lifetime of physical labor. What was left was mostly gray. Her right ankle had never healed correctly after that time a donkey's hoof came down on it at an odd angle. That one tooth in the back of her mouth was giving her trouble again, and a growing pain in her abdomen sometimes kept her up at night. But at least she was alive and moving. Her belly was full of porridge and thick, tasty beer. The late autumn sun wasn't too hot on her exposed face and neck. The flood had been good this year, promising a rich crop at harvest time. She flicked a clod of that thick mud off her foot. Kemet, she thought, the black land. That earth, even more than the kings who mediated between her people and the gods, whose visages stared down from enormous statues and whose names were constantly repeated by administrators and priests, was really Egypt. Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Past Lives. I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks so much for joining me today. When we think about ancient human remains, particularly mummified remains, the first place our minds reach for is Egypt. There are two reasons for this. The first is the centrality of ancient Egypt in our, and I'm using our loosely here, understanding of human history. The fact that the pyramids, temples, and tombs are still visible today, some of the oldest monuments still in close proximity to where people live now, certainly plays a role in that. So too does the continuous presence of European archaeologists in Egypt for the better part of 2 centuries. Hieroglyphic writing was deciphered 200 years ago, thanks to the Rosetta Stone. Napoleon's invasion of Egypt created a craze for Egyptian-style designs and even furniture across Europe early in the 19th century. And since then, Egypt has never really left the popular consciousness. On top of that, much of what we take for granted about how archaeology works and what it can tell us comes from excavations carried out in Egypt. It's hardly uncommon to read a new report on a recent dig and see a section about excavations carried out at the same site in the 20th century or even in the 19th. By the standards of the ancient world, we know Egypt extremely well. We have copious artifacts scattered in museums around the world. I was in Florence, Italy recently, and even the small archaeological museum there has an extraordinary collection of ancient Egyptian objects, sarcophagi, and mummies. There are dozens of places like that museum in Florence, the product of decades of constant excavation and a healthy, if not entirely ethical, market in Egyptian antiquities. Unlike most times and places long ago, we have an almost complete list of Egyptian kings from around 3000 BC, the first being Narmer, all the way down to the last ruler of an independent Egypt, a woman by the name of Cleopatra. You might have heard of her. Even more striking is the fact that the earliest rulers in Upper Egypt would have immediately understood the visual and ideological language of kingship in Cleopatra's time, a sign of the general cultural and political conservatism and stability that Egypt enjoyed throughout those long 3,000 years. We're talking about nearly 30 centuries of continuous history, from the earliest pharaohs who rose in Upper Egypt all the way to the Kushites, Persians, and Macedonians who ruled the country before it finally became a Roman province. Not every age is perfectly documented, especially the eras known as intermediate periods that lie between the major divisions of Egyptian history. We know far more about the elite than we do the ordinary people who farmed fields near the Nile and worked on the construction sites that became famous monuments. Some regions are much better understood than others. Our knowledge of the Nile Valley is far superior to our understanding of the Delta, for example. The long history of archaeological and historical work in and about Egypt sometimes makes this particular field of study insular and resistant to change. Egyptology is a separate discipline from either history or archaeology, with its own training programs and ways of doing things. Despite the copious human remains from ancient Egypt, for example, we have few genetic or isotopic studies of the kind that are remaking our understanding of other ancient societies. Even so, the sheer amount we can and do know about the land of the pharaohs is mind-boggling. From the precise methods of construction used on the Great Pyramid, to the religious program of a zealous reformer, to the lives of the people who built the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, the information we have about ancient Egypt is as abundant and rich as the Nile itself. For the next several episodes of Past Lives, we're going to linger in Egypt and meet some of the people who lived there over the thousands of years that separated Narmer and Cleopatra. We've already encountered one extremely ancient Egyptian, Gebeline Man, who lived before the first kings rose to rule the land from the cataracts to the Mediterranean Sea. But we would be remiss if we didn't also talk about some of the other extraordinarily well-preserved individuals from this extremely well-documented time and place. To do that, however, it's helpful to familiarize ourselves with the broad patterns of ancient Egypt's history, and that is what we'll discuss here today. The basic continuity of Egyptian civilization from before 3000 BC to 30 BC is so obvious as to be a cliché, but that doesn't mean nothing ever changed. Very much the opposite. A great deal did change over time, from the identities of the ruling kings to the structure of the state, to the geographic orientation of the country as a whole. Squaring 3,000 years of incremental change with a deep foundational conservatism is the challenge that everyone discussing the long run of ancient Egypt's history has to face. There are no easy answers. Do we choose to emphasize the unbroken sequence of kings, the similarities in religious expression and language, and the consistent unity of the Nile Valley and Delta? Or should we instead focus on the constant introduction of new deities, the success of rulers of foreign extraction, or the tensions that just as constantly threatened to break the perilous unity of the Valley and Delta, and often succeeded in doing so? Balancing adaptation and flexibility with deeply rooted conservatism was the Egyptian way, and any decent accounting of Egypt's history requires an understanding of both. As we discussed a while back in our episode on Gebeline Man, Egypt wasn't always ruled by a single king. In fact, Egypt as a concept didn't exist before the reign of Narmer, the man generally held as having united Egypt sometime around 3000 BC. I say sometime because the exact chronology of Egyptian history, well, it isn't exact. We have to wait until the period we call the New Kingdom, starting around 1570 BC, for more precise calendar dates. But prior to Narmer, or whoever was the first unifying king back in the mists of time, there was no Egypt, only the Nile Valley and the Nile Delta. Archaeologically, we know far less about the Delta than the Valley at this point in time. In the Delta, the constant movements of the Nile, its flooding and channel shifting, have buried surface signs of a great many archaeological sites underneath thick layers of silt. This phenomenon is also true in the Nile Valley, at least close to the river, where the annual floods deposited tons of soil every year when the waters rose. It was this fertile new soil that gave Egypt its name. Kemet, the black land, as opposed to Deshret, the red land, the arid desert that brackets the river on both sides. Away from the immediate flood zone, however, the Nile Valley is an archaeological paradise. It's one of the most heavily investigated and excavated places on the planet, with an unbroken and well-documented sequence of material culture stretching all the way back into the Neolithic. But for most of the prehistory of the region, the valley and the delta didn't form a natural pair. the Delta was far more tightly connected to happenings in Western Asia and Libya than to the long, thin river valley that extended hundreds of miles to the south. The Nile Valley's more natural orientation was south, past the cataracts, the series of rapids that break up the river near Egypt's present-day border, and into what is now Sudan. Cultural mores and subsistence patterns extended up and down the river from what would eventually become Upper Egypt, all the way south to Khartoum, where the Nile's two major tributaries meet. While we know less about what was happening in the surrounding desert, these same groups probably ventured out into what we now know was a much greener and more welcoming Sahara. Rather than being a land of village-dwelling farmers, the Nile Valley was occupied mostly by mobile pastoralists, cattle herders who moved from place to place and settled down only in death. We know these people largely from their cemeteries, where they buried their dead in elaborate fashion with everything they had worn and used in life. Because cattle herding pastoralists moved around a great deal in search of fresh pastures for their herds, they communicated their identities, who they were and what groups they belonged to, through their bodies. Jewelry, hair decorations, body paints, makeup, clothing, and quite probably scarification and tattooing as well. Upon interment, the deceased had to showcase all of those aspects of their identity to the surviving members of their community. Items like combs, palettes and brushes for applying paints, and necklaces and anklets made from rare stones, gems, and seashells were common inclusions. Whatever they had with them at the time of burial would remain with them in their afterlives forever. The prominence of cemeteries and the emphasis on the body as the major site of identity display would have an extraordinarily long afterlife in Egyptian history. As the Nile Valley became one of the two constituent parts of Egypt, the centrality of the dead and the body wound their way into the developing DNA of Egyptian culture. By around 3800 BC, when the Badarian era gave way to what archaeologists call the Nakata period, farming was replacing pastoralism throughout the Nile Valley. Populations were rising. Permanent settlements were becoming towns, if not yet cities. Powerful men, perhaps the descendants of the old pastoralist chieftains, were carving out a place for themselves at the top of an increasingly explicit social hierarchy. By roughly 3200 BC at the very latest, those chieftains had begun to think of themselves as kings. Three towns, each with their own petty ruler, stood above the rest: Hierakonpolis, Nakata, and Abydos. The rulers of each of those places built increasingly substantial tombs for themselves that they packed with rich grave goods. The earliest examples of hieroglyphic writing come from these tombs, symbols of the increasing power and sophistication of the Nile Valley chieftains. They competed with one another for prestige and territory. And when they weren't fighting each other, they fought their still pastoralist neighbors living to the south along the Nile. This was the time when Upper Egypt separated, both culturally and politically, from the similar regions and peoples who lived nearby. Just as much as the political unification of the Delta and the Valley, it was this severance that created the boundaries of Egypt as we understand it. One of the beefs I have with popular presentations of ancient Egyptian history is this idea that it's all orderly and precise. We know who the kings were, when they ruled, when dynasties fell and why, and obviously we should expect centralized power to one day appear again after these periods of fragmentation and disunity. That's just not how any of this works. Nowhere are these issues clearer than with the earliest stages of Egyptian statehood, what we call the early dynastic period. According to the Egyptian historian Manetho, who lived nearly 3,000 years after the unification of Egypt and on whom we rely for our basic outline of Egyptian history, the first king was named Menes. But the first king we see wearing the distinctive crown of both Upper and Lower Egypt, on a fascinating image called the Narmer Palette, is a man named Narmer. Narmer and Menes may have been different names for the same person. Egyptian kings had a variety of appellations depending on the context. Or Menes may have been Narmer's successor. The combination of radiocarbon dating and estimates from written sources tell us that these two kings, whatever their actions or relationship to one another, lived between roughly 3100 and 3000 BC. And just to be clear, we have no real idea what the unification of Egypt actually entailed, how much progress previous kings had made toward that goal, or what steps remained to be taken after the reign of Narmer/Menes. It presumably involved conspicuous violence, or, alternatively, kings like Narmer wanted to portray their takeover as a violent process. The Narmer palette contains one of the earliest examples of the smiting scene, which depicted the ruler ceremonially beating a captive. A decorated mace head from Narmer's reign records quantities of plunder taken during his campaigns. While these scenes were idealized, there's no reason to think unification was a peaceful, much less a welcomed event. From the time of Narmer, kings were depicted wearing the distinctive crowns of both Upper and Lower Egypt. Visually and ideologically, we can say that Egypt had been unified, if not invented. What that meant on the ground for the people living under the rule of these earliest pharaohs is harder to say. There's no noticeable difference between the tomb of Narmer and his immediate predecessors in Abydos, who belonged to what Egyptologists call Dynasty Zero. It's possible that most or all of the work toward unification had been done before Narmer ever took the throne, and later Egyptians just chiseled away the messy bits to make a cleaner story. Over the next several centuries, however, Egypt did transform into the state and society we in the present are most familiar with. Royal tombs became enormous constructions that took years or even decades to build. These sometimes included human sacrifices, what are euphemistically called retainer burials in the academic literature. The king became the focal point for Egyptian society as a whole, standing at the top of a unified hierarchy. By virtue of that topmost position, the pharaoh gave order and meaning to those below him. If not actually a god himself, he was at least adjacent to divinity, semi-divine, much closer to the gods than his counterparts in the cities of Mesopotamia at that same time. Because of their near divinity, Egyptian kings played an essential role as mediators between the gods and their human subjects. The gods spoke directly to the kings and guided their actions in accordance with their divine will. And the people's service made it possible for the kings to fulfill this role. This was the proper order of things, and order, channeled through the kings, was perhaps the most central concept in the Egyptians' understanding of the world and how it was supposed to work. Their word for this proper order was Maat, associated with light, and the concept was personified in a goddess of that same name. Maintaining the correct relationship between the people and the gods was one foundational aspect of Maat. The other was triumphing over foreign enemies, because proper order obviously involved Egypt being kept safe from the darkness and chaos, Isfet, that represented Maat's polar opposite and threatened Egypt on all sides. While we have practically no details of military campaigning during this period, the early dynastics saw the end of the pastoralist cultures that had existed around the cataracts of the Nile for centuries. The Nubian A group, as these pastoralists are known, were surely victims of early Egyptian state building. By the dawn of the Old Kingdom, the period we understand to be Egypt's first golden age, the outlines of the ancient Egyptian state, society, and culture had all been drawn. The transition from the early dynastic to the Old Kingdom happened around 2700 BC, as the second dynasty to rule Egypt gave way to the third, headed by a fellow named Djoser. You may have heard of Djoser, because he was the first king to build a pyramid. The pyramids are probably the most instantly recognizable expression of ancient Egypt. For at least 3,000 years, the Great Pyramid of Giza was the largest building on the planet, an eternal reminder of the power and will of these ancient pharaohs. While singular in its majesty, the Great Pyramid wasn't alone. Throughout the Old Kingdom, rulers and their immediate family members constructed pyramids to serve as their tombs, bending the resources of a vast and vastly wealthy kingdom to this overarching task. Later kings built pyramids as well, but the pharaohs of the Middle Kingdom used less durable mud brick instead of stone, and those of the Kushite kings are much smaller. Pyramid building and the Old Kingdom are essentially synonymous. Djoser, the founder of the Old Kingdom, built the first, while the last major stone construction was that of Pepi II, the last of the Old Kingdom to rule all of Egypt. This isn't an accidental correlation. It wasn't aliens or secret advanced technology that built the pyramids, but the combined efforts of hundreds of thousands of workers over the course of decades. People were moved en masse by the power of the Egyptian state to building sites, where they were provided with food, tools, and raw materials drawn from the distant corners of the country to provide for and shelter them as they labored. To aid the transportation of goods to Giza, for example, Egyptian engineers built a new river harbor on a now-extinct branch of the Nile. Copper for chisels came from the Sinai. Other materials were sourced from a specially built port on the Red Sea. All of those workers weren't farming while they were cutting limestone and fixing copper tools, so their food had to come from somewhere. That meant administrators had to oversee the collection and shipment of grain and other staples. The Egyptian state did far more than build tombs during the days of the Old Kingdom, but there is no better sign of the capabilities of that state than the pyramids themselves. But while its monuments remain enshrined in our public consciousness, the Old Kingdom didn't last forever. Around 2200 BC, a combination of internal fragmentation and climatic pressure caused by a major episode of aridification, called the 4.2 Ka event, brought an end to the Old Kingdom and inaugurated the first intermediate period. Instead of a single unified state, Egypt split into multiple smaller-scale kingdoms, each with its own ruling dynasty and geographic center of power. This wasn't some brief interlude, but approximately 125 years, or four or five generations, in which there was no centralized state ruling the country. Two distinct centers of power did eventually emerge: Memphis in the north and Thebes in the south. But for much of this period, local leaders essentially controlled their own districts, with as many as 22 petty kings ruling each of Egypt's administrative divisions, called nomes. It's possible, though not certain, that populations declined drastically throughout the Nile Valley during this period. If true, that would be a sign of serious economic and social stress. Eventually, the Theban rulers succeeded in extending their control over all of Egypt once more, inaugurating the beginning of Egypt's second golden age, the Middle Kingdom. The Middle Kingdom was not a rerun of the Old Kingdom. Times had changed. When we look at the wide variety of media produced during the Middle Kingdom, visual, literary, ideological, the opposition between order and chaos, Ma'at and Isfet, becomes much more stark. It's as if the demise of the Old Kingdom shattered some kind of civilizational self-confidence. Now, Egyptians knew, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that chaos could, in fact, triumph over the forces of order, that pharaohs weren't all-powerful, that the solidity of their lives and world were merely illusions. The founding ruler of the Middle Kingdom, a man named Mentuhotep II, was the first pharaoh to be deified while he was still alive, rather than posthumously, as was common during the Old Kingdom. He was also the first pharaoh to be depicted in one of those famous smiting scenes, bashing his defeated Egyptian, rather than foreign, enemies with a mace. The Old Kingdom had seen its share of war, of course, but the pharaoh's role as a bulwark against the outside world became much stronger during the Middle Kingdom. Mentuhotep II, for example, fought against Nubians living along the Nile to the south, Libyans living to the west of the delta, the desert people living to the east of the Nile between the river and the Red Sea, and he probably even led an expedition into southern Palestine. Unlike the long ruling dynasties of the Old Kingdom, Mentuhotep II's line lasted for only a few decades after his death. The 12th dynasty that followed came to the throne amid yet another period of disorder, though this one didn't last long enough to merit the label of an intermediate period. The 12th dynasty's pyramids, built of mud brick rather than stone, were smaller and less durable. They basically look like eroded hills today. Yet the Middle Kingdom was no less successful than the Old, despite the lack of enduring and easily identifiable monuments. Its priorities were simply different. They had to be, because the world itself wasn't the same. Aside from royal monuments, which quickly replaced the self-directed constructions of regional elites, the most stunning examples of Middle Kingdom architecture are the fortresses built to protect the country's borders. New gods came to the fore. This was the period when Osiris became the most important deity for most Egyptians, for example. Egyptian literature flourished for the first time, as the rulers of the Middle Kingdom and their courts patronized poets and authors of wisdom literature. One of my favorite texts from this period is entitled A Debate Between a Man and His Soul, and there's a section I really like about the impermanence of life. quote, the gods who existed previously, who rest in their pyramids, the effective privileged likewise, who rest in their pyramids. Their enclosures were built, but their places are no more. Their walls are lost and no more. Their places like that which has not come into being. Let your heart be informed about it, but let your heart forget about it. It is useful for you to follow your heart while you exist. It's as if to say, even though you know everything must end, you can't live your life despairing over that simple fact. That's a really beautiful thing to read in a 4,000-year-old text. Yet the Middle Kingdom didn't last either. Around 1700 BC, after about 300 years of stability and centralized power, things began to unravel once again. The kings moved their capital back to Thebes in the south, essentially admitting that they had lost control over the Delta and Lower Egypt. This time, however, their rivals had come from outside Egypt. The Hyksos, as they're generally known, had come from the east during the peak of the Middle Kingdom. We can see their increasing archaeological imprint in Lower Egypt in the form of religious and burial practices identical to those found in the Levant at the same time. As central control waned, these people of foreign extraction became the most important political figures in the north, eventually founding the 15th dynasty and ruling Lower Egypt from their new capital at Avaris. They were the first, but not the last, kings of foreign extraction to rule Egypt, and their rise marked the end of the Middle Kingdom and the beginning of the Second Intermediate Period. Whatever Egyptian writers had to say about the Hyksos, however, they mostly ruled in the same fashion as any other dynasty. There was no major cultural or political break associated with their two centuries in power, which came to an end around 1550 BC. A new age was dawning, and once again, the impetus came from the south. The rulers of Thebes had never given up on their claims to power over the whole country, fighting constantly against the Hyksos. We'll actually talk about one of those warrior kings in next week's episode, a fellow named Sekenenre Tau, who died in battle and whose mummy tells us exactly what happened to him at the end. Sekenenre Tau's two successors would go on to succeed where he had failed, founding the third of ancient Egypt's three golden ages. This was the new kingdom, and aside from the pyramids, most of what you and I and the general public probably associate with ancient Egypt comes from this period. This was the era when pharaohs led armies of chariots north and east into Asia, establishing an extended empire that stretched through Syria and the Levant, as well as south into present-day Sudan. New Kingdom pharaohs built the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, filling them with riches like those made famous by the discovery of Tutankhamun's burial site. The famous temple complexes at Luxor and Abu Simbel were the fruits of the New Kingdom's prosperity. As a participant in the rich international world of the Late Bronze Age, Egyptian goods crisscrossed the sea lanes of the Mediterranean and wound up in the palaces of Babylonian, Hittite, Assyrian, and Mycenaean Greek rulers. As a state among states, Egypt was never more powerful than during the New Kingdom, when rulers like Thutmose, Seti, and the various Ramesses made their kingdom one of the linchpins of the world's first true international order. We'll spend two episodes exploring the ordinary folk of the New Kingdom in the coming weeks, one on the workers who built the Valley of the Kings, and the other on their downtrodden contemporaries who constructed a new capital city at Amarna for Tutankhamun's father, Akhenaten, a religious zealot. When this glittering world of palaces and kings crumbled across the rest of the Eastern Mediterranean amid the events of the Bronze Age collapse, New Kingdom Egypt held on, even as the Hittites and Mycenaeans disappeared for good. Another intermediate period followed, the third for those of you keeping score at home, but even then, Egypt retained its basic cultural and political orientation. The foundations laid in the days of Narmer and the earliest pharaohs were still there, holding up the ancient boundaries of the state and its society despite the passing of thousands of years. Egypt would rise and fall, again and again, many times before its eventual incorporation into the Roman Empire. Whether its kings were Theban or foreign, whether it was under the rule of a centralized state or not, Egypt survived, a testament to the power of its animating ideas and the work of generations to weave those ideas inextricably into the tapestry of Egyptian society. They were there when Alexander the Great arrived on the banks of the Nile, and they were there when Caesar, Mark Antony, and Octavian made their own journeys to the land of the pharaohs. They're still with us today, whether we know it or not. animating our most basic concepts of what a civilization and a state are supposed to be. Next time on Past Lives, we'll meet a real person who lived in ancient Egypt. Unusually for us here, this individual was a king, Sekenenre Tau, but his demise was anything but kingly. Thanks so much for joining me today. Be sure to subscribe to our Patreon. It's linked in the description here. The Patreon is only $7 a month, and you get tons of great bonus content like Q&As, interviews, and much more. It's thanks to subscribers like you that we can make this show. If you're already a subscriber, you rule, and thanks so much. If you haven't already checked out my new book, Lost Worlds, you should. It's all about prehistory and what we can learn from the distant past. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. This has been Past Lives.